So tonight I'm going to conclude this three-part series I've been working with, teaching the paramis, the perfections of heart mind. And actually tonight I want to the three we're going to look at are the final three, of course, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. And I want to start by reading a quote from the Dhammapada. Is for those of you who care about these things, it's verse 290 from the Dhammapada, right? If you see a greater happiness that comes from forsaking a lesser happiness, be willing to forsake the lesser happiness for the sake of the greater one. So resolve is to do just that, to see that where this practice is taking you is more important than anything else and has greater potential to make you happy than anything else. And so you go, okay, that's time to get more serious, I suppose it might be, And I read this wonderful description of resolve. So resolve is the energy that translates good intentions into action. Translates good intentions into action. So everyone has good intentions, right? We all have good intentions. We're all going to, like, I'm going to practice more. I'm going to study more, help other people more. But just thinking about those things, imagining what it would be like to actually do that doesn't do much good. I'm just having the intentions but not following through. It's maybe makes you feel good, but that's about it. So you have to sort of transform these thoughts about these intentions into action. And this requires effort. Determination. One of the def I looked up resolve in the dictionary. To reach a firm decision about. And I think the key word there is firm. There's no maybe. There's no, well, if I find the time, or you're going to do this. You have the resolve to actually follow through on your good intentions and act on them and see what happens. My dad used to have this expression he used all the time when he was determined to get something done. He'd say that he was going to do it, come hell or high water. It's like that's, it was like, okay, we're going to get this done. Nothing will stop you. That's the determination you have. The resolve you have is nothing is going to stop me from carrying out these intentions. And the thing is, when you do this, when you actually get to the place in your practice where you start forming very firm resolves, is you have to also be realistic. Maybe you say, okay, I really am going to practice every day for 30 minutes. Or whatever. I mean, for some of you, that's like pfft, easy, easy peasy. And others of you, this is something you're still working on, right? And it's like you have to sort of make something that's doable, but isn't like too much. I mean, don't go from where you are now and say, well, I'm going to practice 4 hours every day, because you just end up getting frustrated. You don't take big leaps; you take small steps, right? And then once you've practiced every day regularly for 30 minutes for quite a while, then you go, okay, I guess I have to sort of up the ante. I have to make a you know make the fir my resolve even firmer, and say I'm going to sit for 40 minutes every day, or I'm going to sit for twice a day for 30 minutes, or whatever, right? And I'm using sitting as an example, but it could be, your resolves are to do more walking practice, or to do Do more service in the world. Lots of ways you can practice, right? It doesn't have to be formal sit-down practice. And the other thing is you should make sure the resolve is wholesome. I mean, I can resolve, well, I'm going to sleep in till 9 o'clock every day. And then I'm going to get up and have a beer and, have two lunches, on whatever, You can resolve. That's a resolve, but it wouldn't be particularly wholesome for me anyway. And so you have to make sure that your resolves make sense and are leading onward to deeper practice. So one way I like to think of resolve is to think of this as like taking the long-term view of things. It isn't like I'm going to practice today, so that might be resolve when you get up first thing in the morning. It's I'm going to practice for the rest of my life. I'm taking this thing. This is how I'm going to lead my life. I'm going to lead my life based on the Buddhist teachings. And then your life becomes your practice. And that's a big resolve, because to really practice and lead your life the way the Buddha taught is quite against our culture and quite difficult to do, to be honest with you. And so it's like, we have to be aware of that. But that's, I think, where this goes. Eventually we get to, we understand that this is what brings the greater happiness. As the Dhammapada has said. And Joseph Goldstein sometimes calls this energy of resolve spiritual urgency. This idea that we have to look at our lives and go, wow, am I ever lucky? Here I am, living where I am, where I can actually, go to a sangha once or twice a week and practice in the morning, and I have time to do all that and whatever else, in terms of your practice you're doing. Because I have enough money, I don't have to worry about just working all the time to, keep food on the table and a roof over my head. I'm not in a place where things are getting blown up on a regular basis, which lots of people live in worlds like that. It's like, and this sort of wakes us up to the fact that, our situation right now, what we have right now, living in this place, in this country, in this town, whatever, is, God, are we ever lucky? I'm always amazed how lucky I am sometimes when I think about it. It's like, I'm so lucky that this is how things are for me, that I have this ability to just practice and teach. But the spiritual urgency part of it is also, but we don't know how long this is going to last. So we sort of think, well, this is going to last forever, right? Well, it isn't. Sorry. It's going to change just like that any day. And all of a sudden, these ideal conditions you have aren't going to be so ideal anymore. Things are going to happen that make it really difficult for you to practice, or maybe make it so you can't practice at all. Who knows? And so we have to wake up to the fact that this is, in this time, in this moment in our lives, this is when we have this opportunity to make this serious resolve and go for it. At the same time, here's the but. At the same time, we have to be aware of not forcing things, not falling into striving, into like, I'm going to do this, whether if it kills me, I'm going to do this because this is what it says I should do in those books I read where all these people are doing these amazing things and they just did this, so I should be able to do it too. And your practice becomes grim if you're not careful. And if your practice becomes grim, if you're overdoing it, then you really have to sort of step back, look at what you're resolved to do, and go, why is this so grim? Why am I making myself miserable with my practice? And then shift your practice so that it makes you happy. Practice should make you happy. That's a radical thing to say, I realize, but it's important. I want to read something that Ajahn Susito has to say here. The Buddhist emphasis on knowing through one's direct experience has always felt very sane to me. The Buddha's Dhamma is shown not through this is truth, this is the ultimate reality, and the secret law of the cosmos, but as this is what you do to get through the mess. I love that. It's like, it's so practical. This is what you do to get through the mess. And it offers an opportunity, a way to explore the mind and step back from the samsara of its turmoil through the simple expedient of picking up a reasonable intention, like focusing on breathing, and witnessing how the mind skids and wobbles around that intention with its transient likes and dislikes, which sort of describes our practice most of the time, right? Our mind skidding around. But it's like we just form a reasonable intention. That's what resolve means doing. We form a reasonable intention, one that we can. I don't know, one of my teachers, Swami Vishnudevananda, used to say, when you make resolves, don't make it too easy, because then it's just like, okay, I can, well, I'm going to practice every day for 10 minutes. I can probably make that resolve, but so what? Right? So I have to make a resolve that's going to push my edge, but not too much, whatever your edge is. And then, so that's the reasonable part of this. And the other thing we have to do is we have to make sure that our practice doesn't shut us away from the world. We don't become, Dharma snobs. This is from Jack Kornfield's book, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry, which I think is one of the best, world's best titles for a book about Dhamma. Right? After the ecstasy, the laundry, which is pretty much what we all have to deal with. When we first enter the spiritual path, we often speak of overcoming of obstacles, necessary striving, the purification of defilements, and the ardor of seeking God. But this language, though it may once have served us, can become excessively one-sided, setting one thing against another, worldliness against freedom, self-will against God's grace, sin against redemption. It's a language built upon exclusion. With the awakening of wisdom, the heart gradually expands to hold the full paradox of life. As Walt Whitman writes, I'm large, I contain multitudes. In the mature heart, there arises a deeper perfection that is not opposed to the things of the world, but holds them all in compassion. I think that's a great description of what we want to strive to do. We can hold them all, but we hold them with compassion. Our spiritual life becomes more about mercy and loving kindness than about struggles over self or battles with ego or sin. Our heroics become a fearless love for the whole of creation, leaving nothing out. We can be present for what Zorba the Greek called the whole catastrophe. In Buddhist psychology, this maturing is described through the image of a poisonous tree, which represents the suffering of the world. When we discover that a tree is in our midst, is poisonous, our first impulse is to try to cut it down, to remove it, so it no longer can be harmful. At this initial stage of practice, our language is one of conflict, fear of poison and impurity, and the effort to root out and destroy that which is dangerous. But as our compassion deepens, we recognize that the tree too is part of the web of life. Instead of devouring it, or destroying it, we respect even this tree, though we also build a fence around it, warning others of the poison so they will not be harmed. Now our language changes to one of compassion and respect rather than fear. Our difficulties, inner and outer, are now met with mercy. This is the second stage of practice. Finally, as our wisdom deepens, we understand that our problems and poisons are our best teachers. It is said that the wisest beings will come looking for this poisonous tree to use its fruit as medicine to transform the suffering of the world. The energies of passion and desire, anger and confusion being transformed into the ardor, strength, and clarity that bring awakening. We understand that it is through facing the very suffering of the world that the deepest freedom and compassion arise. What we once named poison is now recognized as an ally in our practice. That's quite a leap he's suggesting we make here. That we look at all the things we struggle with and go, oh, how can I use that in my practice? How can this be useful? It's a shift, as opposed to struggling and trying to push things away and blaming ourselves and saying, no, no, I should never have that or do that. It's like, how can I, this energy I have towards this, how can I skillfully adapt that into something useful and skillful in my practice? Just, it shifts so that we don't reject anything. We look at everything. We're not afraid of anything. We just let it all in. Sounds simple, right? Why don't we do this then? Why do we have so many good ideas and plans, but so little follow through? Mainly it's because we've become an expert at making excuses for not doing what we want to do. I'll do it when my work is a little less busy. I'll do it when the kids are older. I'll do it in the fall when I don't want to be outside so much. The excuses are endless. You have to actually take this practice really seriously. This is Ajahn Sasito again. Resolve isn't a small matter. If you're looking for the best results or the deepest changes, you have to do that with the understanding that this will most likely mean working at it and overcoming some resistance, and requires the faith that you can at least try. It's a really important line. It requires the faith that you can at least try. Otherwise, you're not going to grow. Naturally, you can develop strong degrees and a further extent of resolve in accordance with a wise assessment of what is needed or useful for you. For example, when you begin to meditate, you might start with 10 minutes and check out how that was. If you get interested, you go on to 50 minutes or half an hour or more. When you read a book, you don't start out thinking that you will read all day and all night, but rather you pick up the book and then you look at it for 10 minutes, and then, if it's worthwhile, you continue. So wise resolve supports strengthening according to feedback, interest, and capacity. It's not blind doggedness. It does, however, mean that you put aside the alternatives and stay with your central aim. The end result is a stronger and more skillful mind, but it means getting over the first hurdle, the idea that lasting personal development can occur quickly with little effort. Frequently, we find ourselves presented with many options, so it's more likely that we'll get exactly what we want. It sounds good, but the multi-option scenario can lead to option paralysis. You don't give due time and effort to changing yourself, and you get the ongoing sneaky feeling that if you'd only done that or bought that one, it would have been better. So resolve comes late on the list of perfections, because to make a wise resolution requires a mind that has sampled, practiced, and received the benefits of generosity, virtue, and the rest. Then you know what a useful commitment is and its results feel like. This is really wise, he's talking about here. It's like we have to not get caught in the what I think of as the bolder option. A different sangha every night for a month, and you still haven't been to all of them. It's so easy to go there, and it can be quite interesting. You see, all these different opinions and all these different teachings. It's so exciting. Have to sort of dig in to one practice, pick a practice, and then stick with it for a long time. By long, I mean Joseph Goldstein. Well, I heard him once say, "Well, once you decide what form of practice you're going to do, you should stick with it for 10 years. And then after 10 years, if you want to look at other things, that's fine, because you're so grounded in your own practice that you're not going to be thrown by things and other practices that sound different, because you'll be able to have a context of your own deep practice to understand them." Wise words from Joseph, too. So this is, I mean, resolve is also, this is where right understanding arises very strongly. There we are at the first step on the Eightfold Path again. But we know we probably come around the loop a couple of times and come back to it again. We need to understand that the greater happiness that the Buddha spoke of in the Dhammapada is the most important thing. You need to consciously let go of some of the lesser happiness to make space in your life for the practice. You have to take a firm resolve. And the amazing thing is that it always works out. This might be my experience. Once I actually take the resolve and do it, it always works out. And it always, I can feel the difference over time. All the reasons you had for not, all the excuses you created for yourself, they just fall away. That's what it feels like. So that's resolve. And then we get to loving kindness and equanimity. These are the last two. And I think of these two both as the results that arise out of working with the first eight, which are really the description of establishing a firm, solid practice and sticking with it. So it's a result of that, but it's also the more advanced practice in some sense. This is where all this other practice is leading to these. And so loving kindness is usually, there's a Pali word, metta. It can also be translated as goodwill. Having an attitude of goodwill to all beings. It's like, just there's the angels after Jesus is born, peace on earth, goodwill to all men. That's what the Bible was actually talking about, having that sense of not excluding anyone. And this is opposed to an attitude of ill will, or wishing that individuals or groups of people or even entire nations should suffer. There's something wrong with them. They don't get the good stuff. Sorry. Which is, you look at our world today, this is basically what's going on in the world. Sad to say. And it seems like a pretty simple idea to just have goodwill to all people, right? We all think that we're good people, that we don't have a problem in this area. The truth is, we all do. We all have reactive mental patterns that cause us to respond to certain people or certain situations with thoughts and even words and actions that express ill will. It's like these are this very deep cultural biases or social biases or whatever. Racial biases, pick your favorite kind of bias. They're there, and we have to be very aware of them, and see that that's where we need to do our work, in a sense. Because, and it's out of these places of ill will that we cause suffering to arise, both for ourselves and for those around us. It's like this is where the suffering arises from our own ill will often. So what can we do about this situation? It would be nice if it's a resolve. There we are. Here we are. Resolve was just right before. So why can't I just resolve to never have any ill will anymore, or to act in unkind ways? But we all know that isn't enough, right? That we easily slip back to our old reactive patterns. Loving kindness is something that we can have to cultivate, to practice. So this is, like I said, both the results of the others, but a practice in and of itself. How can we practice something that's so elusive in a sense? And the Buddha in the sutta, the Metta Sutta, was very poetic and sort of precise about this. First of all, he says, "How intense should this practice be?" And he said, "Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings." Key word there is boundless. A boundless heart. To be just not hold anything back, not exclude anybody, not shut anybody out. So this is pretty serious, right? And then in another place he says, "Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection." This is Buddhist code for all the time. There's never a time when loving kindness isn't appropriate in your life. There's never a time. It's something we just have to consciously tune into when we're not being full of loving kindness in whatever situation, and then consciously choose, take the resolve to learn to be full of loving kindness even in this particular situation. The place where I usually end up ranting about something, can I have thoughts of loving kindness instead? Not easy. So, in other words, we have to do this all the time. The beauty of metta is it's something that you can practice all the time. You can be standing in the checkout line in the supermarket, and it's a long line, and there's some person in front of you who's being, difficult for some reason, and you can either get grumpy about it, or you can have thoughts of loving kindness towards that person. Well, then maybe they're having a hard day, or maybe they're parent isn't well, or their child isn't well, or they're just frustrated about something, and just have thoughts of loving kindness towards them instead. It's a huge shift in the mind. Just that when you see yourself caught in ill will, to just decide, consciously decide, I should shift my mind as best I can to thoughts of goodwill to this person, the thoughts of loving kindness towards this person. Or these people. That's all we. That's the whole practice, right? Want to read something else from Ajahn Susito here. And he's talking about how this works and why it's so beneficial. And he calls this section Accepting Otherness. Interesting title. In the practice of loving kindness, we look into the mind as it is happening, a moment at a time, with the intention to gentle it out of its holds of aversion, depression, and anxiety. So it's talking about mindfulness. It's part of being able to practice metta. Loving kindness is to be mindful that that's what you should be doing all the time. support this, the teaching is that although the sense of self other happens by default, the sense of separation happens by default, we can have some say over its emotional and energetic flavoring. Our current intention doesn't need to be tense, inadequate, and critical. It can be uplifted and uncramped. A sense of self-other can catalyze and give occasion for an intention to offer support. The intention is essential for a happy life, because if we don't use the relational experience in a kind of generous way, if we don't live in the world in a generous way, then defensiveness, anxiety, fault-finding, and grudges are going to haunt our lives and impair the lives of others. Metta is non-aversion, but it is also non-fascination and non-projection. It releases others from being the objects of our projections, lust, and idealism. It allows others to not be the way I want them to be for me. It's a good line. It allows others to not be the way I want them to be. True love for another means that you don't appropriate someone or project your unfilled wishes or needs onto them. Instead, metta means recognizing otherness and feeling that it's okay. We don't have to make people the same as ourselves or judge ourselves based on what we think about other people. We don't have to feel we have to win them over or feel that they should satisfy our emotional hunger. And when metta is fully developed, it can allow us to be with the irritating and the unfair and the messy, so that such perceptions no longer even take hold. I love that line. And when metta is fully developed, it can allow us to be with the irritating and the unfair and the messy, so that such perceptions no longer even take hold. We've changed our habitual patterns. It is the same for ourselves. We hold ourselves with the mind of goodwill. We don't have to feel intimidated and compelled to prove ourselves. We have all been small, weak, and stupid. We've all been totally irresponsible infants, awkward adolescents, made a mess of things, lied, and cheated. Yet we changed. These were all visitors and forces that occupied the mind. Now there's no denying the responsibility for allowing one's mind to be so occupied. But our current responsibility is one of cultivating virtue, discernment, and kindness, not of obsessing and sustaining the burden of guilt and denial. And one of the major healing tools for this process is metta. With this, we take on samsara with non-aversion and non-projection. We can accept the presence of our petty-mindedness, the guilt and anxieties as visitors conditioned into the mind, and work with them. Then there's nothing to hide from or dread anymore. This is a more useful approach than going through another round of anguish, self-hatred, and defensiveness. By stilling these reactions, metta enables us to penetrate to and remove the root cause of ill will, often towards ourselves, underneath the complexes. We have to have goodwill towards ourselves. You know, in the traditional practices of metta, as many of you know, the first thing you always do is have metta for self before anyone else. It's hard to have thoughts of goodwill towards others if you don't have thoughts of goodwill towards yourself. Okay, now moving on. Equanimity, the final parami. And equanimity is the culmination of the practice. It's also, as I've mentioned before in other series of talks, like it's the of the four Brahma Viharas, equanimity is the last one and holds all the others together. The seven factors of awakening all end up at equanimity. So this is in the Buddhist teachings, this is where we're headed. We're heading towards this place of equanimity. But what the heck is equanimity is a good question, right? Sharon Salzberg in her book Loving Kindness defines it beautifully. Equanimity is a spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows us to be present fully with all the different changing experiences that constitute our world and our lives. I want to break this down. It starts with the phrase, it's this equanimity is a spacious stillness. When you're in a state of equanimity, your mind is still, but it's spacious. There's room for everything that arises. It's not still and cramped. Nothing is rejected. Here's another definition of equanimity. This one from someone named Rebecca Bradshaw. Equanimity is continuous accommodation to the truth of the present moment. An equanimous heart mind can connect with this world and all its changes with balance, poise, grace, and flexibility. With equanimity, we learn to trust deeply and relax into our capacity to flow with the river of change. There's that river image again. You know, we can sort of ride along with the flood and not struggle against it, because it's going to be there anyway. Right? Another aspect of Sharon's definition, I think, is also significant, and that's the phrase radiant calm. You don't often see those two paired together that way. Radiant calm. Not only is your mind focused and still, but you literally become a source of this wholesome mind state for others around you. You radiate this powerful energy. This is where the practice leads us, to this place where we can become radiators of calm in the world. I think the world might need a bit of that, huh? Many people think that the practice of meditation is selfish, that instead of sitting around, we should be doing something useful, right? But what could be more useful? What could be more useful than creating an aura of calm and stillness all around you? What does the world need more than that? I can't think of anything. Finally, Sharon says, there's a phrase, to be fully present with all the different changing experiences. This could be a really good definition for not suffering, no dukkha. You suffer because you cling to things that arise that you find pleasant, and trying to avoid and push away things that arise that you find are unpleasant. You don't flow with the river of change. You don't understand or accept that everything is impermanent, constantly changing. If you are equanimous, you no longer suffer. Gasp, right? But if you're truly equanimous, if your mind is truly still and calm and open and radiant, that's where the suffering ends. Now, I want to point out something. This is, you often see the word indifference. And indifference, when you sort of look at it on the surface, sort of looks like someone's kind of equanimous. Like they're just like, kick back, nothing's bothering them, I'm cool, everything's fine. But the difference is, indifference sort of is not engaged with the world at all. It's like, I don't care what's going on. If you're an economist, you care deeply. Your heart is wide open and takes in everything. It's the opposite of indifference. And we have to be careful that we don't Just think, oh, well, I can just sort of lay back and be cool and I'll be at bottomless. It's like you're hiding away from the truth of things. And indifference sort of doesn't accommodate the present moment. It's another way to look at it. It ignores it, essentially. Oh, whatever, I don't care what's happening. Yeah, who cares? That's indifference. Equanimity is infused with loving kindness, a sense of caring for all beings. So these two are very interrelated. There's, like all the Brahma Viharas, there's a way to practice equanimity. And there's usually a phrase. And I just want to sort of look at this phrase briefly here. And this is the phrase that is traditionally taught. You are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. You are the owner of your karma. In other words, karma in this place means that you are the owner of the results of your actions. That's what karma means, the results of your actions. So actually, karma means both action and the results of those actions, when you get technical. But your happiness and unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. This is saying I can't make you happy. Only you can make you happy. I can't be responsible for your happiness. You have to be responsible for your happiness. And equally, you change the you to an I. I'm the owner of my karma. My happiness or unhappiness depends on my actions, not on my wishes. I'm responsible for my own happiness too. This is hard to take in when you start thinking about other people, particularly people you are close to. Your children, your parents, your partners, your brothers and your siblings, perhaps. It's like, because we all sort of feel like it's our job to make everybody happy. We're sort of taught that. That's what we're supposed to do. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do things that might create a situation where someone might become a little happier. So, in Buddhist language, I can do whatever I can to create the causes and conditions such that happiness might arise in another person. But then I just have to let it go. I can't then get, like, what's wrong with you? I did all this stuff to make you happy and you're still not happy, which is where we often end up if we're not careful. Right? It's like we can't make anyone else happy. It's a hard thing to take in, but it's like the truth of things. The only person who can make me happy is me, and vice versa. And why is equanimity so important in our formal meditation practice? This is the last thing I want to mention. And basically, it's from this mental state, this mental horizon of equanimity, that insight into the three, what are called the three characteristics, can actually arise and come to fruit. Practice becomes less about the content of what's arising and more about the process, seeing that all that's ever going on is things arise, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. In my deepest days of practice on long retreats, that's what I start to notice more and more, that all that stuff that I used to get all wound up about and excited about or whatever, because it was fun or enjoyable or horrible, it's just flowing on by. It's like you're sitting on the bank of the river and just being aware of it and being okay with it all and not getting caught by any of it. It's a powerful state of mind. And then you start to see that that's all that's ever going on. It's stuff is arising, it's there for a while, and then it's gone. Everything is impermanent. There's nothing solid, including me. I'm not solid either. Oh, I gotta take that one in, do I? Okay. But that's what we start to see over time. And it's from this mental state of equanimity that this becomes more possible and becomes clearer. These things become much clearer, and you start to experience, the three characteristics as opposed to think about them intellectually, where the practice leads. I have not one, but two poems I want to read tonight. It's a two-poem night. This is from Dana Fald's book, Going In. It's called Remember This. Vast and changeless, the ground of being is not rocked by ripples on the pond. The firmament from which we spring, the divinity at the heart of things, doesn't wax or wane with mind states or wither in the wind. We come from stronger stuff than feelings. Essence does not fail or fade, diminish or trade reality for illusion. We are wordless, wide, and wise beyond time. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. Let that be the focal point of life. Let that be the light that guides us from the shadows. Sounds like equanimity to me. And this is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. And this is part of a longer poem called To Begin With the Sweet Grass. But this is like the last section of that poem, which I always loved. What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself. Never mind that I had to, since somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I have gone out from my confinements, though with difficulty. I mean the ones that thought to rule my heart. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They'll be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment for somehow or another. And I've become the child of the clouds and of hope. I've become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I have become older, and cherishing what I have learned, I have become younger. And what do I risk to tell you this, which is all I know? Love yourself. Then forget it. Then love the world. Sounds like good advice.